saw the federal Germany that in fact took place. He said that Hitler would not be accepted as the leader of a restored Germany. He made the curious assertion that the Americans were only continuing the war to get rid of the Jews, and that there were people in America who were intending to send the Jews to Africa. This was Hitler's dream, of course, that the Jews would go to Madagascar and stay there. Dulles seems to have confused the club land, in other words, the country club view, of blacks and Jews. Dulles now proceeded to supply Hohenlohe with dollops of secret intelligence, announcing that the U.S. Army would not land in Spain, but, after conquering Tunisia, would advance from Africa toward the Plessy oil fields to cut off the German oil supplies. He said that it was likely the Allies would land in Sicily to cut off Rommel and control Italy from there, and thus secure the advance in the Balkans. These things happened, as a matter of fact. Having given virtually the entire battle plan for Europe, top secret at the time, to one of Germany's agents, Alan Dulles proceeded to the almost unnecessary rider that he had very good relations with the Vatican. He said American Catholics had a decisive voice in such matters. Well, as previously mentioned, there is the American naive at work, right there laying the whole thing out, talking to a representative of the SD, somebody who's representing an SD Amtführer during wartime, 1943, telling them the plans of American landings to come, which in fact happened. There was the landing in Sicily, and there was the movement into the Plessy oil fields. Explaining that the Americans would be happy to see the Jews go to Africa and that they should never get back into Europe, et cetera, et cetera. Even if one makes the argument that Dulles was making all these arguments for the sake of convincing the Nazis to make a separate peace, one has to just think about the fact of what those Nazis had already done and even wanting to make a separate peace, let alone making those kinds of promises to the SD and the SS to have Himmler and his boys installed in power in place of Adolf Hitler. These are the political naives, quote-unquote, that were politically and philosophically a little bit unaware when they went into Europe and wound up hooking us up with the biggest aggregation of war criminals since Genghis Khan's horde. I think you could probably figure out for yourself what the truth of the matter was when you look at Alan Dulles and his brother John Foster and their connections into the financial world, their fanatical hatred of communism, and the kind of place in American society that people like the Dulleses and others, a kind of power that they wielded in the 20s and 30s and 40s in the United States. And it begins to make a little more sense than this argument for political naivete as far as the importation of Nazi war criminals.
And whereas the GAO study of 114 aliens turned up five possible fascist collaborators, our examination of the list of the nine most wanted Nazi war criminals found four working for U.S. intelligence, one possibly working for U.S. intelligence, certainly aided by it, one working with Time Life Incorporated, and we'll just see where it goes from here. And you can imagine now, when Alan Dulles was director of the CIA, John Foster Dulles, Secretary of State under Eisenhower, Galen was right in there pitching, and you can imagine what a crew that was and why we wound up with all of these characters working with U.S. tax dollars. Now, one of the things that we'd like to do right now is to... you think we ought to take a break? Maybe give them a couple of minutes to stretch their legs before we finish things up, Nip? Or
okay, that's all right with me. Why don't we do that?
Why don't we take a couple of minutes to listen to some music and sort of stretch a little bit before we browbeat you with a little more stuff? What we're going to do now is take some of these connections and follow them up through history a little bit and illustrate a little bit about how we come to the present situation via this associational network.
Indeed. We're going to give you folks an idea, perhaps, of where some of this is taking us today. And while you're thinking about Alois Brunner and Heinrich Mueller and all the rest of those guys going happily on down the trail while the rest of us have to work for a living, you might want to listen to this, one of my favorite songs. We'll be right back in just a few moments with more of One Step Beyond with Dave Emery and myself, Nip Tuck. I'm John.
One Step Beyond!
John is not with us anymore, but believe me, John, your message lingers on. We have not forgotten, and it is so true. All right. This is Nip Talk back in the studios with Dave Emery here. We're going to spend about another 15 or 20 minutes analyzing a few more articles, and then the phones are going to open up. As previously mentioned, I've been saying previously and aforementioned a lot tonight. As was stated earlier, but that sounds even dumber, we just got a late start tonight for those of you who didn't tune in right away, and shame on you. We're not usually late. You should have been tuned in at 8 o'clock anyway, but we didn't get started until 8:35, so we are running a bit late. We will have phones. Don't you worry. Phones will be opening up probably around 10 o'clock after the next musical break. So right now we're going to jump right back into the middle of this stuff, and where did we stop? Did we stop on, we didn't get to Hjalmar, did we? So we're going to go to Hjalmar now.
Right. Well, of course, we've been talking about some things that are quite some distance in the past. Now, what we're going to do is trace some of these threads forward into the present and examine some of the ways in which this connects with some things going on today and maybe offer a bit of an explanation as to why basically all of our ice cream seems to be turning to horse manure so rapidly here. Now, recall Hjalmar Schacht, finance minister for the Third Reich, Hjalmar Horace Greeley Schacht, as his full name is. Schacht was one of the, his nickname was the Old Wizard, and what he was basically able to do was to utilize his profound connections with American industrialists and financiers, and also with industrialists and financiers in Britain as well, to use these many connections in order to work out a series of agreements on behalf of Nazi Germany, which basically enriched the Reich and gave them a number of very favorable contracts, which would make them very, very powerful militarily. Essentially, Schacht built Hitler's war machine. Now, after a falling out with Hitler, Goering, and Bormann, exactly, his formal argument was with Hermann Goering. I've seen accounts which attribute this, however, to the machinations of Martin Bormann. At any rate, Schacht did break with Hitler just prior to the outbreak of World War II. However, he continued to support Hitler's war of aggression, and his industrial connections were maintained throughout the Second World War. And as we've seen briefly in Charles Heim's American Swastika, while allegedly visiting Switzerland for his health, he made contact with, among others, Alan Dulles, an American diplomat and spy who, as head of the OSS office in Bern, Switzerland, was in the same place as Schacht was. Alan Dulles, along with his brother John Foster, again, two primary operatives in this German-American financial and industrial axis, working through the law firm of Sullivan and Cromwell. Now, after World War II, Hjalmar Schacht becomes the father-in-law of Otto Skorzeny, a key Galen agent, Hitler's commando trainer and rescuer of Mussolini, and also head of the Odessa, one of the post-World War II SS fraternal and protective organizations. Now, Reinhard Galen, of course, went to work for the CIA. Skorzeny went to work for Galen while maintaining very close relations with Hjalmar Schacht. Hjalmar Schacht utilized the series of corporate connections which he used to build up the Third Reich to basically mask a great deal of wealth in a series of corporate fronts, and working with, among others, Otto Skorzeny and Martin Bormann, Schacht then released a great deal of money on behalf of the Federal Republic of Germany after the Second World War. Schacht also continued to conspire with Otto Skorzeny and Reinhard Galen in a number of different ways. One of those ways was to requisition Otto Skorzeny, and according to Paul Manning, Heinrich Müller as well, to put together a bunch of Nazi war criminals, which, acting at the behest of the Galen organization, put together first the Egyptian and later the Libyan secret service. Now, basically, King Farouk of Egypt was overthrown by General Naguib, and the person who was really behind the overthrow, Naguib's sort of controller, I guess you could say, a man who actually was a lower down in rank but apparently wielded the power within the country, Lieutenant Colonel Nasser, okay? Naguib and Nasser overthrew King Farouk in order to curry favor with that government and to lead them to be favorable to the West. Alan Dulles basically sought to build up the Egyptian general staff and the intelligence service. Now, because of the United States' commitment to Israel, they basically were unable to use regular U.S. agents. So what Alan Dulles did was to utilize the Galen organization, all the time, recall, being financed by CIA, and Galen, along with Hjalmar Schacht, prevailed on Otto Skorzeny, Schacht's son-in-law, And according to Paul Manning, as I said, Heinrich Mueller, one of the most wanted Nazi war criminals who we looked on that list, to basically put together, as I said, a bunch of Nazi war criminals, to put together the Egyptian Secret Service. So Schacht, Alan Dulles, Galen, and Skorzeny, three of the key members of this network that we've been looking at for, well, basically Schacht, Galen, and Dulles for about a 30-year period here, cooperate to put together first the Egyptian, then the Libyan Secret Service. Reading now from a book called Skorzeny, Hitler's Commando, published in hardcover by the St. Martin's Press, copyrighted 1981. The author is Glenn Infield, and a summation of the information I'm about to read you is also available in American Swastika by Charles Higham, the book that we read from earlier. About this group of Nazi war criminals put together under auspices of CIA by Galen, Schacht, Skorzeny, and according to some accounts, Heinrich Mueller as well. Talking to Naguib here is General Naguib, who along with Nasser was running the Egyptian government. The takeover of the country by Naguib, N-A-G-U-I-B, with Nasser playing the role of a shadowy dictator in the background, opened the door wide for the three silent conspirators of Hitler's regime, Galen, Schacht, and Skorzeny. As Galen stated in his memoirs, quote, "We found Arab countries particularly willing to embrace Germans with an ostensibly Nazi past," unquote. And Naguib was quick to ask for help. Since his revolt had the backing of the CIA, and he was aware that Galen was collaborating with the U.S. intelligence agency, his request for someone to train his security forces went to Pulak, Galen's headquarters south of Munich. Galen and Schacht were in complete agreement that the man for the job was Otto Skorzeny. Dulles, aware of Skorzeny's anti-Soviet role during the immediate post-war years when the Western nations desperately needed help, concurred. Skorzeny went to Egypt as Naguib's military advisor. It was a decision the United States would regret in later years. Of Skorzeny's team, working for CIA and Galen and Egypt, Infield writes, his, referring to Skorzeny, first task was to organize a staff of former SS and Wehrmacht officers to train the Egyptian army and security forces. He selected carefully, making certain that each officer he brought to Egypt was a diehard Nazi, an expert military tactician, and was anti-Semitic. Recalling the GAO statement that basically naivete led the United States to employ people with a questionable fascist background. Listen to the following accounting of the people that CIA, through Galen, used to put together the Egyptian service. The names here are as follows. Among those recruited by Skorzeny were SS General Oskar Dürlewanger, D-I-R-L-E-W-A-N-G-E-R, who had commanded a brigade composed of poachers, criminals, and men under the sentence of court-martial during the Warsaw Uprising, and whose actions against the Jews had earned him the nickname the Butcher of Warsaw, unquote. SS Colonel Adolf Eichmann, the officer Himmler charged with the destruction of millions of Jews, and who later would be kidnapped from Argentina by the Israeli Secret Service and smuggled back to Israel to stand trial. Recall that according to this account, Eichmann actually worked as a CIA contract agent. Continuing with the list, SS General Wilhelm Farnbacher, F-A-R-N-B-A-C-H-E-R, Panzer General Oskar Munzel, M-U-N-Z-E-L, Leopold Gleim, G-L-E-I-M, former chief of Hitler's personal guard and Gestapo security chief of German-occupied Poland, and Joachim Daimling, D-A-E-M-L-I-N-G, former chief of the Gestapo in Dusseldorf. To handle medical problems, Skorzeny recruited Dr. Heinz Eisele, E-I-S-E-L-E, who had been chief medical officer at Buchenwald concentration camp, and Heinrich Willermann, W-I-L-L-E-R-M-A-N-N, former medical director at Dachau. Again, all of those charmers, including Eichmann himself, working for CIA. Now, one of the things that Skorzeny did while putting together first the Egyptian and later the Libyan Secret Service, and by the way, this is covered in our Radio Free America show number 3. Those shows available if you'd like to call up our phone screener. For those of you who missed the original broadcast, one of the things that Skorzeny did was to put together the first Palestinian terrorists. Okay, he worked with al-Fatah, and during this very same period here, working at the behest of Galen, Schacht, and Skorzeny, Galen, Schacht, and Alan Dulles, Skorzeny puts together the first Palestinian terrorists. And, of course, Palestinian terrorism is something that we've been experiencing ever since, and in our series, on the Hard Rain series, about the Olympics massacre, which we'll pick up again next week. We've been talking about that, and we'll take a look at the association of Palestinian terrorism and Nazism in the past. Of Skorzeny putting together the first Palestinian terrorist groups while functioning under CIA auspices in the Middle East, Infield writes as follows in Skorzeny, Hitler's Commando. Skorzeny was already training an Arab Foreign Legion in commando tactics. This secret unit was comprised of 400 former Nazis and Gestapo veterans and used a training base at Bilbeis in the Delta, B-I-L-B-E-I-S. He also helped organize and train the first Palestinian terrorists and planned their initial forays into Israel by way of the Gaza Strip in about 1953 and 54.
Well, in other words, what we're saying here, folks, is that the terrorist rap, it runs on and it crops up in some interesting places, and of course it leads to some very interesting sets of circumstances. Now, again, as we stated last week, and as we have to state again from time to time, we're not suggesting that a small coterie of Nazis have literally sponsored all the world's terrorism that has taken place in the last 40 years, any more than we would expect you to believe Claire Sterling's claim that the KGB has sponsored all world terrorism for the last 40 years. However, we are suggesting that, as the old saying goes, when you lie down with dogs, you get up with fleas. When you lie down with Nazis, you get up with a curious attitude towards civil liberties, human rights, and the value of human life. And also, you get up with some interesting ideas about how to manipulate political situations. And one of the political situations that one can manipulate is the fear and anger of the public in their response towards terrorism. And as I heard several people talking about on CBC this morning, several experts on terrorism, it's that terrorists almost never get what they say they want in the long run. Occasionally in the short run, they will get some hostages released, some prisoners released, they will get some ransom paid to them, but in the long run, they never do their causes any good. And, of course, we have seen that time and time again, and time and time again, we have suggested that one should examine the possibility of provocative terrorism. Now, lest one think that these examples are all pie in the sky, of course, we've had a very key example going on right this very moment. In the Middle East, and several things have been going on. Of course, one of the things that have been going on has been the change of the mood of the American people, and it has become even more militant than it was in 1979. Before reading the Mary McGrory article I've got coming up, I'm going to read you another short section here from Skorzeny, Hitler's Commando by Glenn Infield that Dave was reading from before. And just to give you an idea again of what we're talking about, Infield writes, Otto Skorzeny not only played an important role in Hitler's Third Reich, but also in the post-war world. In fact, he was the Hitler link to the present-day terrorism rampant around the globe. Now, bear in mind, this was written, I think, in what, 81, okay. So things have obviously gotten even, quote-unquote, worse since then. During the Third Reich, Skorzeny learned an important truth that he never forgot. An act of terrorism committed by a minimum number of persons is very often more effective than a large-scale, complex military operation. Or, as Sun Tzu, the ancient Chinese military sage, said, kill one, scare 10,000. Terrorism during the Third Reich and today has been defined in various ways, Infield goes on, and yet there is no universally accepted definition. The National Foreign Assessment Center of the Central Intelligence Agency defines international terrorism as, quote, the threat or use of violence for political purposes when such action is intended to influence the attitude and behavior of a target group wider than its immediate victims, and its ramifications transcend national boundaries. Now, you might bear in mind there that even the CIA's own assessment of terrorism suggests that it's not always the people that the terrorists are supposedly representing that, in fact, that they are trying to influence, and that in many cases they're not necessarily influencing them in favor of the causes that they supposedly espouse, although that's not explicit in the CIA definition. Skipping to the next page, Hitler and Skorzeny understood that at times the military power of a country could be overcome if one man was dealt with. The German generals were unconvinced at first. They believed that the only way an opposing military power could be defeated was on the battlefield. Skorzeny's forays in Italy, Hungary, France, Denmark, and other countries changed their minds. Okay, bear that all in mind as best as possible, and think about some of the things going on these days. Think about, as we mentioned, I must say that Dave and I were, if nothing else, we were at very, very lucky in late 1979, early 1980, when we suggested that if Ronald Reagan came into office, there would be a wave of international terrorism like the world had never seen, and indeed we seem to be getting it. I'm going to read a short segment of a Mary McGrory column in Wednesday, June 26th, San Francisco Examiner. The headline is America Angry, Dateline Washington. Irony of ironies, Mary McGrory writes, Ronald Reagan, who used to hear that he was trigger-happy, is being asked by a furious public why he doesn't use force against terrorists. Quote, the country, says Representative Robert G. Torricelli, Democrat of New Jersey, is hungry for retaliation, unquote. The message is coming through via call-in shows and letters to the editor, in headlights, yellow ribbons, and angry outbursts against, quote, those Arabs. Americans are fed up with terrorism. They want action. Take out the airport in Beirut. Bomb Tehran. Do something. Representative Benjamin A. Gilman, Republican of New York, reports one major complaint among his constituents. Why isn't the government doing more? When the hostages were seized in November 1979, Americans rallied behind Jimmy Carter, prayed for the safe return of the hostages, prepared to wait. This time, patience, even when advocated by Ronald Reagan, is not on. They're angry with the Israelis for not coming across without being asked. They want the Israelis to turn over their more than 700 Shiite prisoners, whose freedom the hijackers once said was the price of the release of some 40 Americans still being held in the back alleys of Beirut. They are somewhat less angry with the president for refusing to ask the Israelis to, quote, cave in to the terrorists. More and more Americans are gathering under the hardline banner of no deals. Quote, the principal is inching out concern for the safety of the hostages, says Representative Edward F. Fagan, Democrat of Ohio, who fielded furious calls in his Cleveland office from people who feel civilization is crumbling under terrorist onslaughts in Japan, Germany, El Salvador, and the skies over Ireland.
Regarding the skies over Ireland, of course, a plane was apparently bombed, a Boeing 747, and some 329 people were killed. This over the Irish Sea, basically. And at the same time, or almost the same time, a bomb went off in Japan, and this also had apparently come aboard an Indian plane, and this bomb killed a couple of baggage handlers. Well, among the people being sought in connection with these bombings, and apparently, Sikh terrorist groups ostensibly took credit for these bombings, two of the people being sought for questioning in connection with both bombings are a couple of Sikhs who were wanted by the FBI in connection with a planned attempt on the life of Indian Prime Minister Rajiv Gandhi. They also were, among other things, planning on blowing up nuclear power plants in India. Now, we've looked at a variety of different U.S. intelligence operations or alleged U.S. intelligence operations having connections with India, including the possibility of CIA connections to the Golden Temple Uprising, the possibility of CIA connections to the assassination of Indira Gandhi, connections through the Rewald, Bishop Billingham, Rewald, Dillingham, and Wong, a CIA front from Hawaii, which had connections basically providing a conduit for flight capital from India. One of the things that we looked at a couple of weeks ago was the training of the Sikh terrorists or would-be terrorists who had plotted against the life of Rajiv Gandhi by an FBI informant who ran a mercenary training school, sort of a soldier of fortune training school in Alabama. That article came from the Birmingham News. This following story concerning the two of the people trained at Franklin Camper's terrorist training school, or mercenary training school, basically, comes from the New York Times of Thursday, June 27th of 1985. This is a New York Times story headlined, Sikh suspect studied explosives at mercenary school in Alabama. Dateline, Birmingham, Alabama, June 26th. One of two Sikhs being sought for questioning in the crash of the Air India jumbo jet off Ireland and an airline baggage explosion in Japan took a course in explosives at a private school for mercenaries near here, according to the school's director. The Sikh, Lal Singh, is suspected by the authorities to be the L. Singh whose name was on the passenger manifest of a CP air flight from Vancouver to Tokyo, but who did not board the plane. Baggage from the flight exploded after being unloaded, killing two people. The second suspect, Aman Singh, flew to Toronto before the ill-fated, Bombay-bound Air India jumbo jet left that city, according to reports from Canada. The plane crashed into the sea, possibly because of a bomb, and all 329 aboard were killed. Earlier, the Federal Bureau of Investigation was said to have begun a search for the two men for questioning in connection with a purported plot to assassinate Prime Minister Rajiv Gandhi of India while he was in the United States this month. Three other Sikhs who were said to have attended the mercenary school with Lal Singh in November were taken into custody for questioning by the FBI in connection with the purported plot. Lal Singh never seemed like a bloodthirsty person, said the school's director, Joseph Franklin Camper, Jr., a 38-year-old veteran of the Vietnam War. He was just a good student and did what we told him to do, unquote. He said Lal Singh had taken part in the school's explosive ordnance demolitions training, which teaches the handling of mines and grenades. But Mr. Camper said, quote, "We have never taught anyone how to build a time bomb," unquote. We have mercenaries in Africa, the Middle East, all over the world, he said at the school. What they do after they leave here is a different story, unquote. Well, again, the fellow who trained them is an FBI informant. Information coming from a variety of sources, including the Birmingham News story we looked at a couple of weeks ago, Covert Action Information Bulletin, and in as much as an FBI informant trained these particular individuals, it raises some questions about the apparent inability of the FBI to turn up the two individuals in connection with this plane. Again, remember the mood that various terrorist incidents have stimulated in the country, and remember some of the things we've talked about some of the development of terrorism, the connections of Skorzeny, Allen Dulles, and so forth, and recall, as we've mentioned in the past, too, that the Nazis specialized in provocation, staging a terrorist incident in order to inflame your own people by blaming it on an enemy.
Now, last but not least, something to think about, something that, again, may go into the just the strange coincidence file, or may not, as the case may be, but we're just going to throw it out and let you think about it. The article is from the New York Times for Monday, June 24th. However, what's significant is the date of the event itself, and we're going to discuss that. So, again, something to put in the interesting coincidence file and to keep in mind in case something crops up later on. It's an obituary. It's Professor Ted L. Stein dies at 32, aided case on Iran hostages. Ted L. Stein, a professor at the University of Washington School of Law, died June 12th in a fishing accident in northern Oregon. He was 32 years old and lived in Seattle. Mr. Stein served as counsel to the State Department in 1979 in its case in the International Court of Justice charging Iran with illegally holding United States citizens hostage. He received the Francis Deak Award from the American Society of International Law in 1983 for an article he wrote on the Iranian hostage crisis and the World Court. He also served on the Society's Executive Council. And it goes down to list his background and his graduation and his surviving family. Now, again, perhaps just coincidence, rather far-flung, but something to note anyway. Here's Professor Stein worked in the case of the Iranian hostages with the State Department as a counsel in 1979, died June 12th, and then June 14th. The event of June 14th, as we will see from a San Francisco article for Saturday, June 15th, 1985, but 2 days after Professor Stein dies, of course, we all saw these headlines. Terror flies in Mideast skies, 110 hostages aboard hijacked jet. Dateline Algiers, Shiite Muslim hijackers forced an American airliner with at least 110 hostages aboard to fly back to Algiers today and release three more hostages in the fourth stop on a day-long flight of terror. And, of course, the 14th, the day before this paper came out, was the day that this most recent hostage crisis began. So, again, you can make of that what you will. It's just something to file away. We do find a lot of these strange coincidences cropping up later on in a lot of the stories we cover, which is one of the reasons that we keep going back to these stories.
Of course, Jimmy Carter's popularity didn't gain very much from the hostage crisis. His image as being incompetent received a good deal of momentum from that. And, of course, we've looked at in the past, in fact, just a couple of weeks ago, information that Francesco Pazienza was the source for Michael Ledeen and Arnaud de Borgrave's damaging information about Billy Gates. So, again, Mr. Carter's wound up with a lot of mud on his face. Some of it appears to have been deliberately generated by forces opposed to him. Remains to be seen what we find out about the hostage crisis.
Indeed. And I'm sure that's something that you folks will want to talk about. I'm personally going to boogie on out of here and go home and do things that have to be done. But Dave will be here until 11 o'clock to answer your phone calls. And as a matter of fact, that's what we're going to do right now is break for those phone calls. So if you want to give a call to One Step Beyond, 415-941-2500 is the number. Going to be a short break for a couple of minutes. And after that break, 2-3 minute musical break, and then the phones will be open. So 415-941-2500. Remember also just to mention one time at the break here, coming up on Thursday the
Thursday, July 11th.
11th, there you go. July 11th, we'll be having Radio Free America, this time talking about the Aryan Nations and related groups. That's from 7 to 11 p.m. Thursday, July 11th. Okay, so phones open, 415-941-2500. Give us a call and get on the air with us here at One Step Beyond KFJC, Los Altos Hills.
The sun shall not smite I by day, nor the moon by night, no. And everything that I do shall be upward and right. And if it's all night, it's got to be all right. If it's all night, it's got to be all right. Hey, mama, don't lose this one. You're the lucky one under the sun. If you make me move, then you know you've got to prove all night. It's all right. Night shift, walking on a night shift with the forklift from a.m.
Did you say that? Why did you say that?
To p.m.
Working on.
Alrighty, 415-941-2500. Unfortunately, Nip Tuck has to return back home, so I'm going to be handling the phones all alone here between now and 11 o'clock. But between now and 11 o'clock, that's what we're going to do. We're going to take calls, and those of you who have any information you'd like to share with us, give us a call, 415-941-2500. We have a full board right now, but as soon as you hear us hang up with someone, then you can give us a call at that number, 415-941-2500, and hopefully you'll be able to get on at that point. Good evening, Fremont.
Hey, Dave. I got a quick comment on what Nip was saying. He said that Galen actually joined up with the U.S. intelligence before the war ended.
Mm-hmm.
And apparently, according to Cookridge's Spy of the Century, he didn't actually get captured by the Allies till late May of 45.
Well, that act that
was the, over. And well, and when the war was still going on, he refused to even contact with the Americans or British, though a lot of his associates did. Schallenberg,
Larry,
and so on, but he had apparently nothing but scorn for them.
Larry, the war was still going on at that point, but not in Europe. I think maybe that's what he meant. In other words, VJ Day wasn't until August.
Okay, I'll
45.
Go for that. Okay.
Okay, but you're right. The war in Europe was over at that point.
I've seen that. There's an amusing quote in As It Is, which is a little newspaper published by the Hare Krishnas.
Uh huh.
And
speaking of Galen organization,
story, yeah, exactly.
Go ahead.
Story about the title headline is Ford Motor Scion Weds Australian Krishna Devotee, and there's a little quote. Reporters asked Ambarisha, that's Alfred Ford's Krishna name, if he thought great grandfather Henry Ford would approve. That's of him getting married to a Krishna lady.
Mm-hmm.
I think so, Ambarisha replied to the media. He was into some pretty avant-garde things.
Yeah, well, Nazism was one of those things, I guess, if it would qualify as avant-garde.
Certainly. I just thought that was funny.
It is interesting. I remember seeing a picture of the Hare Krishna temple near Detroit, and they had, is it Henry Ford III or Alfred? What is his name? Which member of the
Ford?
Alfred Ford. Okay, they had a picture of him and I guess the daughter or granddaughter. I think it was the daughter of Walter Reuther, formerly the head of the United Auto Workers, and both of them were members of that particular Krishna temple. So I guess under the benign influence of whoever or whatever, the lion was lying down with the lamb in Krishna land there, so to speak. But That's interesting that, you know, because we've talked about the Hare Krishnas, which are one of these groups, and the question of mind control enters in there. There is a split within the Hare Krishnas. Apparently, there is a German-born fellow named Hans Kary, who has a name of, I believe, Hans Aduta Swami, and he apparently has been espousing some rather fascistic types of doctrines and stocking weapons, but he has been... there's a split between he and his wing of the Krishna movement and the leadership, so it's important that we not attribute some of the activities of the Hans Kary people to the Krishnas as a whole, although I can't say for sure that they're not involved, but there is, it's worth noting as we, you know, this as we touch on the Hare Krishnas, that some of the Nazi-type activities that we've talked about in the past are only attributable to one group, of one branch of it, at least as far as we know.
Well, I don't know about their politics, but their food's really good.
Yeah, I just, some of their politics, I once was approached by a guy from the Hare Krishnas who was telling me that Hitler was an avatar and how he didn't kill anybody, it was all the British and so forth, and how Hitler, you know, didn't eat meat and was an enlightened soul, which was, I found it a novel interpretation of history. But that apparently is only one group of the Hare Krishnas, at least as far as we know.
All right, that's it. Thanks a lot.
Thanks a lot, Larry. And good evening, Sunnyvale.
Hello, Dave. This is the Field Marshal.
What's on your mind, FM?
Well, nothing really on my mind. I managed to attend a very interesting church meeting, sort of an Independence Day church meeting combination. And it was titled God Bless America, so I thought I was going to be in for a little trouble. And I walked in while this military chaplain's army chaplain was busy spouting off some of the worst red-baiting propaganda I've ever heard in public, ever. It was really savage, and I mean, he just sort of glossed over the Vietnam War, almost glorified it. You're familiar with Ronald Reagan's analogy of the Soviet Union to the evil empire?
Uh-huh.
Well, he rubbed that in constantly, and in the background, he had flashing pictures of the flowing grains and the waving flag and the military in the back and the military color guard and the whole thing. It looked like the Nuremberg rallies, and I was looking like just aghast. This guy was spouting everything off. I mean, just brushed over racism, brushed over the way we treated the Indians, just screamed freedom, 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 and, you know, what price freedom, and they had this corny-ass singer with his, you know, slick delivery, you know, screaming, you know, associating this country with its almighty God and everything. I just wanted to get up there and scream. You know, it was really scary. It really was.
Where was this now?
This was off of Marymount Avenue, or Marymount Avenue, Mountain View, Christian Church.
And who was this guy? Now, what was the name of this guy that you liked so much?
I didn't count. I wish I got a program. I think his name was Anders. I could be wrong. Chaplain Anders. Evidently he did some time in Vietnam, and... the dummies just sat there just chewing it up. I mean, if there's ever a need for someone to run out there with a tape and just plug it in, here's the real truth, folks. I just wanted to, you know, shout all these specific, you know, like Operation Paperclip or anything else like this. I mean, he was associating the United States with virtually heaven. It was just, you had to be there. I mean, I walked out just sickened, you know. I mean, I was sickened. You know, it was just, you're right about, you know, terrorism and everything, getting very angry and everything. This guy was really capitalizing on it. I mean, you have to be there to believe it. You really have to be there to believe it. I can't even find words to describe it. It was really bad. I mean, it was just... The only thing that was missing, I really hate to say this, was the armband. This guy's really going lunatic. For a guy to be in the Army, I mean, just to go out there and just... You know, inner workings of the Army, and I'm sure he knows better. Just go out there and just sit in front of this audience and just scream, "Aren't you all proud to be Americans? Aren't you now?" And the military color guard and people out there just singing these wonderfully patriotic songs in the middle of Silicon Valley with its NASA and its Lockheed and its Nazi connections. It just, I mean, the stupidity. It just, I could not believe it when I walked in. It wasn't subtle. It wasn't a distribution idea. It was ramming down people's throats. And I got out there quick because I felt I really had a need to go out there and get an argument with someone out there. So just get out of there quick. I couldn't believe it. I mean, they had a huge American flag draped on the, against the west side of the church, and just, they call it the bayonets and everything. It was just, you know, really, really subtle. You know, it was as subtle as a kick in the teeth.
So, in other words, well, to hear you describe the experience, Larry, no one would ever know that you didn't like it.
It was really, if Larry didn't, or anyone who had been a regular KFJC listener had walked in there, they would have just been floored. I mean, really floored. I mean, he did Ronald Reagan one better.
Well, what, I mean, other than the fact that you obviously like this guy a whole lot and would recommend going back to anybody who wants to hear some fine oratory, what is the specific point about this guy and his oratory that, you know, is it anything beyond what you've already stated, or just that this fellow apparently is not someone you enjoy too much?
I got lost on it. Well, I mean, the thing, he really ran down the Soviet Union. I mean, he really emphasized the point that, you know, dying, I mean, he associated Vietnam with the liberation from the communist evil. It couldn't be anything with drugs or the flying tigers or anything like that. It couldn't be that we were invading a country and the Tonkin Gulf Resolution had anything to do with it. No, we were out there fighting communist aggression. He actually called the Soviet Union an evil empire over and over and over again. How disgusting they were. And, you know, we got to fight socialism. I'm proud to be American. I'm proud to be American. Heil Hitler. I mean, just the screaming, the ignorance. I mean, the...
Right, right. I think we got a pretty good idea what it was like, Field Marshal. You've given us a good description, but again, if there's a particular, if there's another level that you're going to move to, or something more you wanted to say, I think we've got to
bring this up. You know,
I think we got a pretty good idea what this guy was like and what you think about him.
It's going down now. Really is. It's really going down now. I think a lot. You're going to see a lot more of these particular type of rallies. And I wouldn't be too surprised in holding a big football stadium because, you know, like I said, the terrorists have just been released and all that anger and, you know, the Nazi provocation you were mentioning earlier on, it's working. And guys like this are going to be capitalizing on it. And I just want to, you know, make a note of it. It does go down this valley, and it was pretty bad. It's pretty bad. Pretty sorry. I just want to make a kind of point because I was quite outraged by it, and I just had to get off my chest.
Well, again, no one would ever detect the outrage in your tone of voice.
No, just really. I wish they had more of it, but it was... It was, like I said, it really looked like Nuremberg rally. The military does not belong in the church with its bayonets and everything. It was just really classless all the way around. And if anyone out there is, you know, listening to me, they better pay attention because, like I said, it is going down this valley. You're going to see a lot more of it.
Okay, well, listen, if you hear of any other social activities that you'd recommend for the members of the listening audience, let us know, Larry. Or Field Marshal, rather.
I will.
Okay?
I will.
All right.
Take it easy, okay?
Okie doke.
Right, bye.
Thanks for calling. And good evening, Sunnyvale.
Can you hear me okay?
Yep.
Oh, good. Had a little problem with the phones earlier. Speaking of social activities,
mm-hmm.
There's interesting social activity that's coming our way in October. I'd like to read a short article from, of all things, the calendar section of the Los Angeles Times yesterday, Friday, or a couple days ago, Friday, February, or June 28th, 1985. Excuse me. And it's a film article. It's not yet a, a film critic, but it's a little bit of L.A. information on Hollywood's latest project, and I think we'll all find it quite interesting.
Okay, well, why don't you let it rip, and let's see what Tinseltown has in store for us.
Okay, once again, Friday, June 28th, L.A. Times, page V1. It's in the film clip section. It says, the conspiracy from the mafia, .. to the Vatican, by Jack Matthews, Times staff writer. Beginning, imagine that the newly elected president of one of the world's largest corporations is about to announce wholesale changes in company policy, unaware that those changes will affect profitable relationships with both the international banking underworld and the mafia. Imagine that the night before he makes his big move, an assassin slips him an undetectable potion that prompts a fatal heart attack, and that after a new boss is elected, it's business as usual. Imagine that all this really happened in 1978, just this way, except that the chief executive was Pope John Paul I, and that corporate headquarters was the Vatican. Now try to imagine someone wanting to turn this hot potato into a movie. Quote, this is not an anti-church film, end quote, insists producer Richard Martin, who sends, quote, it's called The Conspiracy, into production next month in Dubrovnik, Yugoslavia. Quoting again, we don't go into religion or philosophy. It's just a good dramatic story. What do we, and then another quote, what do we think of taking someone's death and exploiting it commercially? Asked screenwriter executive producer Bill Byrne. B-A-I-R-N, anticipating a question? Well, that's difficult to answer up front. I think it's a story that deserves telling. But I guess the best defense is the people who are doing it, and it's a good list. Michael Anderson, an Oscar nominee for Around the World in 80 Days, will direct a cast that includes Paul Scofield as John Paul. Paul Scofield, for those film fans out there, played some kind of cardinal in A Man for All Seasons in 1966. Played Sir Thomas More. Anyway, Robert Mitchum is a corrupt Vatican archbishop, which would be Marcinkus, right?
Mm-hmm.
And Christopher Walken, who is quite good in, this is an aside, what was that film? The Deer Hunter, right?
He was in The Deer Hunter, yeah. Go ahead.
Yeah. As the investigative journalist who, in unraveling the financial scandal, becomes embroiled in the assassination plot. Baron, who also has 8 years invested... Let me start again. Baron, who also has 8 years invested in a script about a Sicilian underworld leader, says the reporter is the only fictional character in the conspiracy, created as a dramatic thread to weave the documented elements together. All others are based on real people and will use the real names. Martin and Baron say they're...
Excuse me, caller, let me interrupt you. Could you edit down the rest of this article here? Because we're constrained for time tonight. I think we've got the thrust of what this is about. Why don't you edit out the key points from what's left in it and present that to us, and then we can kick this around.
The next two paragraphs, I think, are key. Martin and Baron say their years' research in Italy turned up fresh evidence supporting earlier theories, and 5 books have been written on the subject, the most recent, In God's Name, that the charismatic John Paul, after only 34 days in the papacy, was murdered. And then quoting, "Circumstantial evidence is so strong that it's hard not to take it seriously," Martin says. So, another interesting film coming down the pike.
Alrighty, well again, we've been talking about conspiratorial politics in the Vatican for quite some time, and In God's Name by David Yalop talks about the very thesis the film is called Conspiracy...
Conspiracy, and they're starting the shooting schedule in Dubrovnik, Yugoslavia.
Better call that the filming schedule rather than the shooting schedule. I could Aja had the shooting schedule. Martin and Baron sound like they have the filming schedule.
Well, hopefully the security apparatus in Yugoslavia can protect them from whatever would have befallen them. They were interested in filming it in Italy,
mm-hmm.
And a number of advisors to the production outfit thought that would be a very bad idea. And it talks later on in this sort of scoop on what's coming up in Hollywood. It talks about the P2. It
mm-hmm.
talks about the Marcinkus connections. It talks about the American Catholic Church and their connections. And it talks about the motives that were really brought out well in God's Name. And so if the producers are of this film are referencing a book such as In God's